You're listening to the Bold True Life podcast with Hana and Maimuna. We're sisters, life coaches, and we have honest conversations about what it takes to blaze your own trail in life.
This means we'll be talking about the triumphs and the struggles of showing up to our lives with authenticity, courage, and mindfulness. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the Bold True Life podcast, everybody. This is Hana.
And this is Maimuna. Today we have Leila Al-Aryan with us. We are super excited. Leila is an Emmy Award winner for a show called Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English. And Leila, I got to tell you, I kind of discovered you through, it wasn't an interview, it was kind of a live event that was airing online. So I watched you online and you were speaking about your show. You were very like open and vulnerable, talking about the effects of dealing with people who were traumatized and how you take a break and kind of sit back from that. I was just so intrigued by you. Can you just introduce a bit about yourself and what you do and kind of your background as well?
Sure. Thank you. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for having me. So I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist pretty much for almost, I guess, 20 years, which is kind of crazy to say. But, you know, I've known I wanted to be a journalist since I was very young, probably somewhere between, you know, 11 and 12 years old. Although I found even earlier home videos of myself pretending I was a TV anchor when I was about nine.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, I've always kind of known since I was a kid that I wanted to be a journalist for a number of reasons. And, you know, I've been really lucky and fortunate and blessed in my life to actually realize my dream. And I'm now an executive producer, or the executive producer of a show called Fault Lines, which is a documentary, short documentary and current affairs program that's on Al Jazeera English. So it airs internationally on TV and it also is available online in the US. People can watch it on YouTube. If you search Al Jazeera Fault Lines, you could find it easily. It's free to watch. You can stream it. And it's a show that focuses on, you know, US issues. So anything from the heroin epidemic's impact on kids to the fact that in jails and prisons across the country, there's private healthcare companies that provide healthcare for the prisoners and sort of all the issues that involve, you know, kind of private corporations providing healthcare to vulnerable people who don't really have a say in who's providing their healthcare and whether there should be a profit motive for that, to investigating the Boeing 737 MAX airplane. And, you know, the fact that it crashed in Indonesia and Ethiopia, two countries very far away from ours, and highlighting the stories of people you know, halfway around the world who are impacted by an American corporation. So if we do go abroad, our issues always have to have a pretty strong U.S. connection, unless we're in Latin America, you know, Central South America or the Caribbean, in which case we don't need to have a strong U.S. connection. But that's the show, and I've been with Fault Lines since 2012. I started out as a producer and then became a senior producer, and then a year ago I was officially the executive producer.
Oh, congratulations. That sounds exciting.
Thank you. It's definitely been interesting being a manager.
Yeah.
It's been interesting and challenging in different ways, but yeah, I think I'd say that a lot of the issues we cover deal with trauma. We're talking to people kind of in the, a lot of times in their worst moments or about their most painful experiences. So, and I think when the event you watched was me talking in part about the band. So last year, you know, I was awarded a news and documentary Emmy for an episode called The Ban, which was filmed in 2017. And it's about the Syrian family. So basically, Donald Trump, you know, signs, one of his first actions in office is to sign an executive order banning people, citizens of seven Muslim majority countries, from coming to the U.S., the fulfillment of a campaign promise to ban Muslims. And immediately I kind of sprung into action, really wanted to cover it. And, you know, I speak Arabic, so I felt like you know, a lot of the people affected were Arabic speakers. So I pitched my executive producer at the time to produce this. And then I basically called everybody I know who remotely had anything to do with refugees or immigrants. And it just became this like kind of obsession for the next few days to find cases of people impacted and to tell those stories. And eventually, this Syrian refugee father living in Istanbul started sending me WhatsApp messages. And you realize all over the world, people really rely on WhatsApp as a means of communication. And he started sending me videos of himself with his children. And he was so desperate. You know, he said, I'm a Syrian refugee living in Istanbul. We were supposed to come to the U.S. You know, they stopped our travel. Two of my children are very sick, one of whom is in the ICU. So we got on a plane. It was actually kind of one of the craziest deployments I've had for work, because I had my son's fourth birthday party. And then that night I had to like get on a plane to go to.
Wow.
It was just such a crazy, like emotional
kind of
ping pong. And then my son during his birthday party started shivering and had a fever, of course.
Oh,
I'm like very anxious to get on a plane. Tell the story, and my son is sick, and you know, but then I think what sort of drives me a lot is just this sense of like, I have to tell these stories and I have to shed light on these issues. And it's just like this sense of mission that I think is really important to have, and a sense of focus. So, and I had already sent the correspondent and the cameraman a day earlier, because we knew that this case was very serious and it could change very quickly. So they beat me to Istanbul and they started filming with the family. And then I got there and we kept filming some more. And there were so many challenges. Like, you know, you're already kind of sneaking a camera in a hospital. The hospital didn't really want us in there. They didn't want us filming. So we had to be really careful. Turkey in general, it's become more challenging to just film on the street because, you know, there was an attempted coup a few years ago. Their authorities are just very sensitive to journalists, to cameras. So, on top of that, obviously this family is letting you in, but at the same time, they're going through a really, really stressful, difficult time. And making documentaries, you're kind of demanding a lot of the people you're talking to. It's not just a quick hit and you're gone. You're spending hours, sometimes days with them. And then his wife, you know, they come from a very traditional kind of conservative village in Syria. So she didn't want to be on camera at all. So having to kind of, there is a small scene in there where she's covering her face, but I just felt like it was really strong because she had just found out that her son's condition had deteriorated. And I asked her, you know, can I film you, but I won't film your face, just while she was talking about her feeling, hearing that news. So on top of that, you're a journalist, but you're also a human being, and you're asking people, like, can I talk as they're going through this trauma? So it takes a lot out of you. So on our last day that we were in Istanbul, I got a message like around 5 a.m. from Abu Yahya, the dad, and he told me his son Yahya, who was in the ICU, had passed away.
Wow.
It was just horrible. He was 6 years old. He had this very rare immunodeficiency, and he was being held in a hospital that didn't even have a pediatric ward. It was not equipped to deal with his condition at all. And obviously the father felt like coming to the U.S., being accepted as a refugee, was really a way for him to start over with his family, to build a new life, and to get his son the best medical treatment. And before he was able to do any of that, his son passed away. And I think it was just so painful to hear that. But at the same time, I think the family truly felt like the only way to get people to care is to tell their story, even during painful times.
Wow, that's just listening to you tell it all over again. I get chills. Do you keep in touch with them at all? Have you talked to them?
I do, especially during like Eid, or if there's like a, you know, big occasion, I try to ask them as much as possible, how are you doing? So eventually, and I think, you know, it's really hard as a journalist to feel like you're making impact. But luckily, once the documentary came out, their younger son was moved to a much better hospital. People donated money to help them. even we heard the president of Turkey was personally invested in the case and kind of asking about how things were going. And then UNHCR, the UN Refugee Resettlement Agency, actually expedited their case and ended up sending them to Germany. So okay. They've lived in Germany for the last couple of years. They seem to be doing really well. They had another baby. You know, it's always, I think, an adjustment for refugees to live in a completely, or anybody, immigrants, but especially refugees who are also trying to overcome trauma. But I think they're doing pretty well. And yeah,
it's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, Leila. So our stories never really start with ourselves, especially when our own parents come from another country. There's often this entire history of people and experiences that get passed along to us that a lot of other people around us can't fully relate to or grasp. So can you help us understand you a little bit better by telling us more about your own background growing up Palestinian and how it shaped you?
Sure. Sure. So I would say my story actually starts with my grandparents' story, which, you know, my grandparents, all four of them, three of whom have passed away, were born in Palestine. And they were all from, you know, one of them was from Gaza, but the other three were born in cities that are now Israel. So our story is a story of loss, of displacement. My maternal grandmother, her father was actually rounded up and killed, buried in a mass grave of Palestinian men. And this all goes back to, obviously, the establishment of State of Israel in 1948. You know, this trauma doesn't stop with that generation. It continues, and it impacts every part of your family's life. So my parents were not born in Palestine. They were born in the Gulf. My mom was born in Saudi Arabia. My dad was born in Kuwait. Mm-hmm. Their fathers and mothers moved there because Palestinians were forcibly expelled from areas that became Israel, and they were under occupation, and life just became, you know, untenable. You just couldn't stay there. Like I said, my grandmother's father was killed, so there was that shock and that trauma early on. And then my parents were born in countries that never fully accepted them, that in many ways saw Palestinians as burdens, looked down on them, didn't give them opportunities. When they were children, both of my parents moved to Egypt, and that's where they grew up, and that's where they met. And I think life was okay there, but for my father, what ended up changing sort of the course of his life was when Anwar Sadat came into power, he changed the rules so that Palestinians were actually restricted in what they could study. So, you know, my father had this dream of studying science, being a doctor. He was a very, very, very hardworking, studious kid, very book smart. And, you know, he just felt like the walls were kind of closing in on him. And then his father told him, you know, I have these life savings. Why don't you apply to universities and colleges in the UK, the US, wherever you get in, wherever you want to go, I'll support that. And it's something that I've carried with me my whole life, which is just Palestinians really put an emphasis on education, on studying hard, working hard. It becomes this means of survival, like this means of, like, you know, we've been displaced, there's been an ethnic cleansing of our people, but if we study hard, if we work hard, education will be kind of the key to helping us do well wherever we are. Obviously, in many contexts, that's not possible. So, for example, in Lebanon, again, there's so many restrictions on what jobs Palestinians can have, on where they can study, even on where they're buried. Like, there's special cemeteries for Palestinians in Lebanon, I discovered the other day. So, you know, this, I don't want to sort of glorify education because it's not always the key if you're limited in even what you can do to begin with, or you're limited in leaving. But, you know, my father ended up coming to the U.S. to study, and my four siblings and I were all born and raised in the U.S. So I think growing up, you know, we always just heard about Palestine. It was very, you know, near and dear to my parents' heart, even though they weren't even born there. But you can't really escape being Palestinian. You know, it's impacts what opportunities you have. It impacts so much. It is your identity no matter what.
Yeah. As I was researching you, I Googled you, of course, to do this interview with you. And it just made so much sense because a lot of your stories come from like your experiences growing up. Winning an Emmy seems glamorous and it seems like you've broken through a ceiling. But when you take a step back and zoom out and look at your life, it seems like you just are motivated by something completely different. And it's not glamour and the glory of, it's more like life gets real. And so you just do what you got to do.
Yeah, I would say I had a pretty challenging childhood. My dad was an activist on the Palestinian issue. He organized conferences and published a magazine and was just really active. I think sometimes to the detriment of being around his family. I think we often felt like we were sharing him with whether it was the Muslim community or, the Palestinian cause or whatever. So that was sort of inescapable. But I think for me, my journalism is my sense of mission. It's just telling important stories, especially stories that no one else is telling, and, giving voice to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get their voices out there, who don't have that platform. Yeah, and I think it's just, especially in this age of social media influencers and how many followers do you have?
Right.
What brands are sending you free stuff to unbox? And just I think it can be really easy to get caught up in kind of celebrity. And I just think, I try to stay focused on what matters and ultimately what legacy you'll leave once you're gone.
Yeah.
If you're comfortable to share, can you tell us a little bit about the experiences that you've had with your father and what your father went through working on spreading the, the truth and the reality behind what your country and your people have been through?
Sure. Yeah. So my father, like I said, he was a very prominent American Muslim activist working in the, 90s, early 2000s. He obviously worked on the Palestinian issue. He had conferences. He organized. It's undeniable how kind of pro-Israel the U.S. is, both in terms of giving billions of dollars in aid, military assistance, support in Congress, the media. So my father really tried to counter that as much as possible to give a different perspective, especially during the first Intifada when Palestinians were rising up and resisting decades of occupation. And the official Israeli policy in response to that was to break the bones of Palestinian protesters, many of whom were children or teenagers. So my father really felt the need to kind of speak out and give that other perspective. And in response, the pro-Israel lobby took it upon themselves to try to destroy him and destroy our family's life. So this massive pro-Israel Islamophobe by the name of Stephen Emerson made a documentary in, I believe it came out in 94, called Jihad in America, that aired on PBS, quote-unquote documentary, not a real documentary. It's a piece of propaganda, tried to say that my father was, a jihadist terrorist, that he was engaged in, support for Palestinian armed groups and all of that. And after that, the FBI actually raided our home. My father became, the subject of an investigation. And for years and years and years, they couldn't charge him. They couldn't do anything because he'd committed no crime. It was very clear. But he was suspended from his job at the university. So he was also a university professor at the University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida, teaching computer engineering. And so obviously our life was very much, and I guess there was a lot of scrutiny by the FBI. They were recording our phone calls. They were going through our trash. My uncle, Mazen, was arrested on an immigration violation and held under secret evidence, which was a provision that was passed in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing and this law that Congress passed. It said that they could use secret evidence against immigrants. So they would hold people without telling them why they're being held. They wouldn't tell them, and they also wouldn't tell their lawyers. So the government would just tell an immigration judge. So it was blatantly unconstitutional. Obviously, everybody has the right to know what they're being accused of. But the reason they arrested my uncle was to basically try to get him to give them anything about my father. Obviously, my uncle said, I don't have anything to tell you. So this just kept continuing. My dad then campaigned against the use of secret evidence in the late 90s. And he managed to get a bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats to sponsor a bill repealing the use of secret evidence, which was, I should say, it was primarily used against Muslim immigrants, a couple of dozen Muslim immigrants and maybe like one non-Muslim. So it was very clearly targeted. Because of my father's success in organizing to end the use of secret evidence, he also, was politically involved. Unfortunately, people know about the story, but in the 2000 election, basically, we should remember it was the Clinton administration that was using the, secret evidence against Muslims. They were problematic in a number of ways. And then during that campaign, the Bush campaign was kind of aggressively courting the Muslim vote, let's just say, whereas the Gore campaign was very hands-off and not as interested in Muslims. And then the Bush campaign basically said, look, we're going to end the use of secret evidence. They agreed. And Bush even declared in a debate, presidential debate, live on television, that he was going to end the use of secret evidence and even compared it to driving while black. So Muslims then decided to endorse Bush. My father obviously was in Florida. That ended up being the deciding sort of factor. Muslims didn't realize at the time the fact that, this candidate was surrounding himself with neocons. I think there just wasn't a full picture of who he was, and people kind of maybe imposed a little bit more. But obviously, this was the issue that ended up being a really symbolic issue. Mm-hmm. And 9/11 happens, and the same forces that had been trying to go after my dad for years and years and years that couldn't get any charges against him because, there wasn't any evidence, ended up mobilizing. And my father, in February of 2003, was arrested at home, and our home was raided once again. He was held under the most atrocious pretrial conditions for a year and a half after that, which even Amnesty International condemned as torture, akin to torture. Wow. Solitary confinement for 43 straight months. At one point, he was banned from even phone calls with his families for, I think, 6 months. He was denied any contact visits. So we would see, convicted felons would be able to hug their families. And my father, who hadn't even gone to trial, we'd have to see behind glass. So it was very clear to us very early on that there were two systems of justice, and that Muslims had a very different set of rules, imposed against them in this kind of post 9/11 world. So my father would say after that, well, we went from secret evidence to no evidence under Bush. So obviously things took a dive after 9/11. And then after a year and a half, he was put on trial. It was a 6 month long trial. The government spent millions of dollars on it. They flew in something like 83 witnesses from Israel.
Unbelievable.
It was crazy. I mean, these witnesses were testifying to attacks my father had nothing to do with. The government even conceded, these men, and I should say three other co-defendants, were arrested along with my father, which was deliberate because they ended up building a conspiracy case. And in conspiracy cases, it's how they used to try, the mafia, the mob. So anything your co-defendant says can be used against you. So it's much easier to kind of prosecute a conspiracy case than just one person. So it was crazy. It was a really crazy, obviously, life-altering experience. I went from being a college senior to having to travel around the country fundraising for my dad's legal defense fund. We learned very early on justice is not cheap in this country. If you end up with the weight of the U.S. government against you, all the resources the government has, you have to raise at least $1 million for good lawyers who know what they're doing, experienced lawyers. We had to kind of convince people to donate to support who were terrified, who were worried they'd end up on some list if they supported us. Yeah, it was a crazy experience. sometimes I feel, I don't know, it was all just a crazy nightmare. But
yeah. And your father, how is he now?
Alhamdulillah. So it's such a long story. Like, I think we could do a full episode
just on this. Yeah.
I think it went on. It basically, the case went on from 2003 to 2015.
Wow.
Wow.
Unbelievable. So this is a whole,
So in 2015, he was ultimately deported. He had to leave the country. He never became a U.S. citizen because of his activism. He was denied citizenship. And so he couldn't stay in the country, even though I should mention he was acquitted by a jury, 10 of whom wanted to fully acquit him, two of whom ended up being holdouts, and they wouldn't say why. They just said they had a gut feeling he was guilty. Very long story, but you know, his case basically dragged on and dragged on for many years. This really pro-Israel prosecutor in Virginia tried to bring my dad up to Virginia after his Florida case ended, tried to basically build a new case against him in Virginia. That dragged on for an absurd amount of time, like 7 years. Finally, in the spring of 2014, the Obama administration just dropped the remaining charge that was brought about by this pro-Israel prosecutor in Virginia, which was a charge of criminal contempt for not testifying before a case against the think tank in Virginia called Triple IT, which that case ended up falling apart anyway. And then my father was deported to Turkey in early 2015. He's doing well. He's working there. He's, you know, thank God he's a free man. There was a very long period of time in which we thought he would spend the rest of his life in prison.
Wow. Where do you go from there? that's a lot. That is a lot. I guess the question is, and I think this is what intrigued me about you, was that you, you know, the whole kind of mission of Bold True Life is all about courage, like having resilience, having courage, hitting those rock bottoms and getting back up again. We really feel that having courage is like a spiritual practice. I was intrigued by the Emmy and like breaking the glass ceiling as a woman. That's how I got introduced to you. But then the more you unlayer and the more you unpack, I realize like you've been through it. You built a certain muscle, you built a certain strength through your life, and what you've been through helped you build it. What are the lessons you learned from having kind of going through what you've gone through? What are your biggest lessons from like your rock bottoms in your life and how you get back up from that?
Wow. I think what helped a lot is, you know, kind of following both of my parents' example of just having a lot of faith. Like, I think their faith never wavered. And I think I'd say kind of one of the most consistent themes of my life and the lessons I've had to learn is definitely resilience. And I think it's a lesson. I don't know if my parents were necessarily intending this to be one of the main lessons they taught us, but definitely through just life experience, we've had to learn it pretty early on. And I think just strength as well. And what's helped a lot with that is just having perspective that we're not the only ones, that, you know, you can't find a single Palestinian family, or it's very difficult, that hasn't had a loved one in prison, for example, including children in prison. And then, you know, our own experience with the American justice system before my father was arrested. I'd never been to a jail or prison in this country. I'd never seen the way that families are being treated. It's not just the prisoner himself or herself who's being dehumanized, it's their family members as well. Just the entire process of visiting a loved one in prison is incredibly dehumanizing. We would see families who drove, I don't know, like 15 hours to visit their loved one in prison be turned away because what they're wearing was not appropriate or the wrong color or whatever it was.
Oh my God.
And it was just incredibly eye-opening, you know, just how predatory prisons are. It's really expensive for families to afford, for example, a prisoner calling, collect calls, or, you know, things like the canteen, just the way that the dehumanization continues for years on end. But I think, yeah, I guess I would say we had incredibly difficult times in our life, especially with my father's experience, when, you know, people kind of turned their backs on us. weren't really there for us. And I think what helped a lot was just this constant reminder that we're not alone. There's other people going through exactly what we're going through, and that we have to just stay strong and keep going, because the alternative is defeat and despair. And who does that really help?
And you were saying also, like in a previous conversation, like your mom had a hard time with just like, what was the reaction of people around her and like friends, family, people who you thought were close to? You kind of get to know who your people are when you're going through definitely. Times like this.
For sure. I mean, I would say the community in Tampa was very afraid. There's a lot of fear. And I think some of it was probably, you know, justified in the sense that the FBI was going around and kind of harassing families, talking to them, interviewing them, trying to get information out of them after my father was arrested. So it was a very clear kind of intimidation tactic by them. And the result was people, you know, my father had been such a pillar of the community. He founded a full-time Muslim school. He was the imam of the mosque. He just did so much for the community. He was an organizer. And the response was for the community to kind of turn their backs on my family in a large sense. My mom would go to the grocery store. People would pretend like they didn't see her, turn their backs. She was actually told not to bring my siblings to the school that my father had founded, so she had to pull them out and put my siblings in public school. So it was a very trying time. I think the people who overwhelmingly showed up for my family in Tampa were members of a progressive church there that had a strong emphasis on social justice and human rights and, you know, just these very basic principles that everyone deserves a fair trial. They would have rallies in front of the courthouse and hold banners that said charity to orphans and widows is not a crime. They would, you know, write letters to the editor, you know, organize events in the community in support of my father and his co-defendants. So I think when you actually see people doing good as well, that restores your faith in humanity.
Yeah, you have a very, like, a unique perspective on, like, what it is to live in fear. And I think, you know, pockets of minorities do in this country, but that's a whole, that's an interesting perspective experience to have in this day and age.
Yeah, I think what I didn't expect is like how painful just like regular life events would be when you're going through a traumatic experience. So, you know, attending a wedding or, I don't know, a birthday party or just anything happy, it was very difficult to deal with, which I wasn't really expecting. Even my own wedding, to be honest, like I didn't really want a wedding. It was just, I think after years of trauma and kind of living on edge and not knowing what was going to happen to my father and my family, my father was basically facing life in prison. And, you know, it was something that hung over us for many years. And even after he was acquitted and after, you know, he was put on house arrest, and I mentioned his case kind of dragged on for years, it was difficult to kind of just get back into a mode of just living a normal life and like kind of getting over that experience. So, yeah, I think the feeling of isolation and like just kind of having difficulty getting back into normal life mode was, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, that is true. Like, it's like, am I supposed to forget the last how many years that happened?
Also, I mean, physiologically too, it's just, it's very confusing for your mind and your body to be on one end where you're just like constantly worrying and anxious and trauma, and then to switch over to happy mode and like functioning and day-to-day life. It's just, you know, hard on the body too, not just...
Yeah, that's something I learned. I did this after my experience doing my episode on the ban. I did a fellowship for journalists. It's the Dart Center at Columbia University, and they do a fellowship for journalists who've covered trauma or experienced trauma or had secondary trauma. And I learned a lot kind of about how the body reacts physiologically to high stress situations and kind of how the fact that it ends up having an imprint on you long after the event. different tactics for overcoming that. But yeah, that's totally.
Yeah.
So just on that topic, now that we're touching on self-care a little bit, Leila, can you tell us what do you do for yourself when you realize you need a break or it's starting to become too much in terms of the work that you're doing now and all of the trauma that you're facing as well as just in your day-to-day life?
Yeah, I don't think I'm the best person for this because I don't think I do enough. I think it's trying to just be aware as much as possible of your feelings, because I think oftentimes we just feel these really intense emotions and then we respond and we don't know why we're responding the way we're responding. So I think it's just trying to really break down like, okay, I'm feeling anxious because of X. Well, is this a realistic worry? Is it a productive worry? So kind of like asking yourself a series of questions about why you're feeling the way you're feeling and then kind of addressing that. So I think for me, rather than kind of budget in self-care time, like let's say once a week I'm going to do this, it's more just like a practice of being a lot more mindful and aware of my feelings and my behaviors and trying to address them as they come up. And then I think it's also just focusing a lot on gratitude and just a general mindset. So constantly, you know, if I'm feeling down or I'm feeling anxious or, you know, some of the trauma that I've been through, I've witnessed, you know, feels overwhelming. I think I try to redirect those thoughts to just feeling gratitude for what I do have. And that tends to help a lot as well.
So we do have our final questions here. We've been with you for quite a bit. This has been really great. Aside from what we've talked about, kind of bringing it back to like your life today, you're a parent, you're a mom of two, you're married, just in like your everyday life, what's one fear that has recently felt gripping or overwhelming, but you've overcome it? And what's a truth that you held on to do it, to overcome it?
That's a good question. I actually haven't thought of that question. I think generally I've developed some anxiety after becoming a mom just because, you know, it's such a massive responsibility and it's such a precious gift. So I think, I don't know if I could think of a specific fear, but a more general fear that something will happen to my kids or, you know, they'll get hurt. And I think what keeps me going and what kind of alleviates that fear is just knowing that ultimately it's not in my control and making that decision to give up the control and to kind of have faith that everything will be okay. And to know that human beings are very resilient. So,
yeah.
And that resilience is actually a gift. So I think one thing I think about a lot as a mother is kind of giving my children the gift of resilience while also wanting to protect them from the world and trying to really achieve that balance as much as possible. So it's something I think about a lot. And I think definitely my parents gave me the gift of resilience and strength. And, you know, I'm not sure that I've always gone through everything and, you know, in the smoothest of ways, but, you know, I hope to do the same for my kids.
Yeah. Motherhood is a huge responsibility and a challenging one. And our very last question for you, is also related to our title. What's one way that you'd like to show up more boldly to life these days? Or a way that maybe you recently started showing up more boldly?
That's a good question. I think one thing I would like to do, and maybe this isn't the deepest answer, but I realized some time ago that I could probably use a bit more balance in my life as far as I work a lot and work takes up such a big part of my life. And then obviously when I'm not working, I'm being a mother and that's another big part of my life. And I think in general, when women become mothers, they kind of neglect to find maybe hobbies or passions or things like that that are outside of either work which takes up, you know, for a lot of people, a disproportionate amount of time of their life and their waking hours, or being a mom. So I think the way to live more boldly is to discover passions that are separate. And I think it could lead to higher kind of life satisfaction to have a different outlet.
That is super deep, actually.
That's a good one, yeah.
Like, find the little joys, right?
Make I think time it's important. For
them. Yeah. Prioritize them, yeah.
Otherwise, I think when something goes wrong at work or when something goes wrong at home, you end up feeling like it just feels so heavy because you don't have other outlets.
Yeah.
That takes such a big space in your life, you know.
Yeah.
One thing I've tried to do is to see people, whether it's like a performance or a movie or like an artist or, you know, something where people are at sort of the height of their talent. I find that really, really inspiring.
Mm. And
it's just a very nice kind of outlet and distraction from day-to-day life.
Mm. And I think it also gives you a sense of hope when you see people just in, like you said, in their element, you know, and in their joy and not constantly in this place of just survival mode, which I think is a lot of life for many of us.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it for sure.
Yeah.
It's a balance, I think, to a lot of the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Layla, thank you again. We really, really appreciate you being here, and we enjoyed having this time to sit down and chat with you. If people would like to connect with you online, is there anywhere in particular they can follow you or Fault Lines?
Yeah, they can follow me on Twitter at Layla Alarian. And Fault Lines is at AJ Fault Lines on Twitter. And I also have open direct messages. So if they want to write me on there, that works as well.
Nice. Okay. And we'll have all of that linked down below in our show notes for everyone. And to everybody listening, we really appreciate you as well. Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, and if you know anyone else who'll enjoy it, make sure you share it with them. And we will see you all next month.
Nice.
Thank you guys so much.
This has been a great conversation. Thanks, Layla. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys.
Bye. You made it to the end. Thanks so much for listening.
Don't forget to subscribe, and you can find us at boldtruelife.com/podcast or your podcast player of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google.
We would love to hear your thoughts on today's conversation.
If you like what you hear, please take 2 minutes of your precious time to rate and review.
It really helps us out. Thanks.